headlines. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry and Amnesty International welcomed the International Criminal Court's move towards investigating Israeli war crimes. The Biden administration formally notifies Congress that it will remove Yemen's Ansar Allah movement from the U.S. government's list of foreign terrorist organizations. Also ahead, the U.S. Treasury warns that the current crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic would have a lasting impact on black Americans unless action is taken. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the International Criminal Court rules that the court has the jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories, paving the way for an investigation into Israeli war crimes. The ICC said its territorial jurisdiction in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel since 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry hailed the decision, saying it's ready to cooperate with the court. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the decision as an important development, urging the court to investigate Israeli war crimes. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced the ruling and called the court a political body. The U.S. State Department said Washington objects to the move. Amnesty International said the court's decision marked a long overdue step towards justice for victims.
The ruling opens the way for an investigation into crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. These include allegations against Israel of war crimes, including settlement-related activities, and crimes against humanity, such as persecution, deportation, and transfer, as well as the crime of apartheid against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank.
Amnesty International said the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity have evaded justice for more than half a century. Back in 2019, ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda called for a full investigation into Israeli war crimes, but asked the court to rule on the territory over which it has jurisdiction. She subsequently ruled that Palestine is a state and the ICC has jurisdiction involving its cases. Late last year, the U.S. imposed sanctions against the court. Neither Israel nor the United States are members of the ICC, and both have vowed to prevent the court's probe into the allegations of crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. Political commentator Bruce Katz says the ICC's ruling is a real game changer in the sense that it has overruled Israel's objections to an investigation into its war crimes.
I certainly think this is a game changer in the sense that Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis at this point. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, we need to remember that Trump is gone. Now, President Biden will face an interesting challenge here because were he to disavow the ruling by the International Criminal Court, that would be, something that would harm his, or at least the perception of people, of different publics around the world, in terms of his presidency, the decision.
The United States will revoke the decision of the former administration to designate Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization. The U.S. Secretary of State formally announced the decision to Congress on Friday. The State Department says the decision was made after a comprehensive review of the last-minute designation by the former U.S. administration. The department said the reversal is in response to Yemen's humanitarian crisis. Washington has also promised to halt its support for the Saudi and Emirati-led war on Yemen. The former U.S. administration drew international criticism for blacklisting Ansar Allah. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations slammed the move, saying it will push millions of Yemenis into a large-scale famine. Over 5 years of Saudi and Emirati-led war on Yemen has pushed the country into what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Colin Cavell is a professor of political science from Bluefield State College and joins us now. Professor, welcome. It's good to see you, as always. Does the Biden administration care about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, or was this reversal decision made on the backdrop of the widespread condemnation from the international community?
If they cared about the people of Yemen, they would not say that they're still going to fight Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they would stop altogether arming Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian genocidal policy to exterminate the Yemeni people is the cause of this. So why does Biden say, well, we're going to make sure that we defend Saudi Arabia at all costs? What they're doing, this is for political purposes, and that is why they're saying they're going to pull out of Yemen. But they're not going to pull out of Yemen. They made very clear that they're going to continue to fight Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they're going to use that pretext as a fight against the Houthis when they think it's in their interest. So the war is still a war of aggression by Saudi Arabia on the Yemeni people, and it is still supported by the United States and the United Kingdom, but this is a little pivot in the nation trying to garner some international credence to say that things have changed. We are no longer the imperialist nation we have been all along. But I would not close my books too soon on that.
Right, so basically, Professor, what you're saying is Biden's saying that he's ending support for the Saudi war on Yemen, but he didn't call on Saudi Arabia to end its war on Yemen, considering...
Absolutely not. In fact, he doubled down and said, we're going to make sure that Saudi Arabia gets whatever it needs in order to defend itself. So this is hypocrisy galore.
And when you say get whatever it needs to defend itself, you have to consider the fact that most of the bombs that Saudi Arabia are dropping in Yemen that are killing Yemeni children are made in the United States.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. We have blood on our hands. And so Joe Biden saying that we're ending our part in the war on Yemen, if you really were ending it, then you would quit arming Saudi Arabia. You would cut off all arms to Saudi Arabia. And you would not use this pretext of, well, we're ending the war, but we're still going to go after Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which they will use as a pretext to go after the Yemeni liberation fighters.
Right, yeah. So in essence, nothing has changed in the U.S. backing towards Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen.
Well, diplomatically and politically, people will say, oh, the Biden administration is so great. They're finally realizing this humanitarian catastrophe that has killed over 100 million people and put 24 million people into hunger. They're finally doing something. So people in the United States who support Joe Biden will say, well, see, he's doing really good things.
Okay, Professor Cavell, thank you very much for clearing that up. Colin Cavell there, Professor of Political Science at Bluefield State College, joining us out of Bluefield. Now, in a virtual meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has discussed a host of issues, including the Iran nuclear deal, with a group of European foreign ministers. In a tweet, the French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, described the talks as important conversation on Iran and handling the nuclear and regional security issues. During the meeting, Germany and Britain backed the revival of the Iran nuclear agreement, officially known as the JCPOA. Washington unilaterally left the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. A year later, Iran started to scale back its commitments after the remaining signatories to the deal failed to make up for the U.S. moves. The new U.S. administration says it will return to the pact only if Iran does so, but Tehran insists it is Washington who should first return to the deal. Now, the U.S. Treasury Secretary says the crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic would have a lasting impact on African Americans unless action is taken. Janet Yellen made the remark in a virtual meeting she and Vice President Kamala Harris held with dozens of members of the National Black Chambers of Commerce. Yellen said economic crises hit people of color harder and longer. She stressed that during the early days of the pandemic, African Americans were the first to lose their jobs. The recession has hit women and minorities particularly hard, with businesses owned by African Americans closing at twice the rate of their white counterparts. Elsewhere, the coronavirus death toll in Brazil has passed the 230,000 toll as the South American country registers the fourth consecutive day of over 1,200 fatalities. More than 9.4 million have contracted the virus in Brazil. Meanwhile, Mexico reported more than 1,300 daily fatalities, raising the overall death toll to over 164,000. The United States is the worst hit country by the pandemic. So far, more than 450,000 Americans have lost their lives to the fast-spreading virus. Daily deaths remain high at more than 3,000 a day. More than 27 million cases have also been registered in the country. U.S. Democrats paved the way for approval of President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 aid package without Republican support. The U.S. House of Representatives approved a budget outline that enables Democrats to push for Biden's coronavirus relief package in the coming weeks. The budget resolution enables Democrats to pass Biden's plan by a simple majority. Earlier, U.S. Democrats called for the quick approval of the aid package to fight back the negative impacts of the pandemic. Biden also called the current economic and health situation in the country a national emergency. That's in the wake of new signs of economic strain brought on by the continuing health crisis. The United Nations Secretary General welcomes the formation of a new interim government in Libya.
I welcome the selection by members of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum of a unified temporary executive authority. And I call on all members of the dialogue and the Libyan and international stakeholders to respect the results of the vote. It is essential that all foreign fighters and mercenaries move first to Tripoli and Benghazi and then leave the country according to the new schedule that was defined.
Now, this comes after a UN-led forum voted on the interim government to run the war-torn country until general elections are held in December. Turkey, which has troops on the ground in Libya, also welcomed the formation of the interim government. The North African country plunged into chaos after the 2011 ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Since then, the country has been ravaged by violence amid conflict between the two seats of power based in the cities of Tripoli and Tobruk. A fragile ceasefire agreed in October has largely held. Tim Anderson is the director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies and joins us now out of Sydney. Tim, it's always good to see you. What's your reaction, what's your views to the latest developments in Libya, including the new interim government there?
Thank you. Yes, it's a temporary compromise which all sides have applauded, but it hasn't resolved the underlying tensions there. And this is the problem of 10 years of disastrous fragmentation in this country after NATO destroyed the government 10 years ago. We have two NATO powers fighting for influence, France and Turkey, and we have other powers, Russia and Egypt, very concerned that there isn't a resurgence of a sectarian Muslim Brotherhood in Libya. So the issue hasn't been resolved, but for the time being, there are representatives from the two rival governments in this interim body.
Do you think foreign parties will respect the what the UN General Secretary General has said and try and bring work towards peace in the country, in the war-torn country, especially the two sides that you cited, Turkey, which has troops on the ground, and then France?
And indeed, Mr. Erdogan has refused the call to withdraw his troops, which include mercenaries recruited from North Syria and from the region. France is at odds with its NATO partner over that. And as I said, Russia, there's not just two sides, there's more than two sides there. So those sides want peace on their terms. So the crunch hasn't really come yet. Let's see if the elections are going to resolve that. But I suspect not. The problem is from the long term that their political will has been destroyed in Libya for the last decade. And I think that's something that suits NATO in many respects.
Right. So just finally, with regards to the elections, the upcoming elections at the end of the year, you don't... are you optimistic about that? Do you think they can stretch to that to until the end of the year, with it being peace on the ground in Libya?
It's difficult to say. There's not a really... I don't think anyone can make a confident prediction about that, because, as I say, foreign powers have now entered into this ambit, and it's going to be played out according to those interests. And Turkey and France and Egypt, of course, has a very important stake, because it has a very long border with Libya, and it doesn't want to contemplate a resurgence of a Muslim Brotherhood, which it had experience with in Egypt. So these foreign influences are not played off so easily, and it seems unlikely that even an election is going to resolve those tensions.
Okay, Tim, we'll see how that one unfolds in the future. Tim Anderson, thank you very much indeed. He's the director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. Tim joining us out of Sydney. Now, Russia has expelled diplomats from Germany, Sweden and Poland for attending last month's protests in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. In a statement, the foreign ministry said Moscow considers the actions of the diplomats unacceptable. Meanwhile, Sweden has reacted to the measure, calling it, quote, completely unfounded. Poland also has summoned the Russian ambassador over the decision, warning that Moscow's expulsion of a Polish diplomat would deepen the crisis in bilateral ties. In a joint virtual press conference, leaders of Germany and France have also denounced the expulsion of foreign diplomats by Moscow, with the German Chancellor describing the move as unjustified.
During our meeting, we were informed of the expulsion of German, Swedish and Polish diplomats from Moscow in connection with demonstrations on Navalny. We consider this expulsion to be unjustified, and we believe this is a further step away from the rule of law noticeable in Russia right now.
With regards to the case of Navalny, I condemn very strongly, from its start to its end, what has happened. The poisoning, the terrible conditions of his return to Russia, the sanctions and the conviction, and today, the expulsion of German, Polish and Swedish diplomats, which was decided by Russia.
The move by the Kremlin comes amid heightened tensions between Russia and Europe over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his recent imprisonment. He was arrested late last month after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment. His arrest then triggered unauthorized street protests in a number of cities. Russia has repeatedly said that Navalny's case is a domestic affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. That wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
While 122 countries voted to ban nuclear weapons, the United States pursued a project to threaten China with a nuclear attack. In August of 2019, the United States withdrew from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, tested two intermediate range missiles, and then posted an order for a variety of cruise and ballistic missiles. When the US government sought bases for these missiles around China, its Asian allies balked. They do not want to inflame the already tense situation between the United States and China. The article you're about to hear has been written by Vijay Prashad, an Indian historian, editor and journalist. The piece is titled, We Can't Give Up, an Idea of a Nuke-Free World. The article has been taken from the Asia Times website. Please stay with us for more of Vijay Prashad's article. On 22nd of January, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons became international law for the 122 states that signed the agreement in July of 2017. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, as with most treaties, is summed up in one sentence, Article 1A. Each state party undertakes never, under any circumstances, to develop, test, produce, manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess or stockpile nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. There is no complexity here. This is a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. Wilfred Burchard was the first non-Japanese journalist to visit Hiroshima after the atomic bombing of that city. His first dispatch for London's The Daily Express on 5th of September 1945 was titled The Atomic Plague. Wilfred Burchard wrote, In Hiroshima, 30 days after the first atomic bomb destroyed the city and shook the world, people are still dying, mysteriously and horribly. Hiroshima does not look like a bomb city. It looks as if a monster steamroller had passed over it and squashed it out of existence. Wilfred Burchard said, I write these facts as dispassionately as I can, in the hope that they will act as a warning to the world. The damage is far greater than photographs can show. It gives you an empty feeling in the stomach to see such man-made devastation. In 1952, Sakamoto Hatsumi, a primary school pupil who had experienced the terror of the bombing, wrote a short poem. When the atomic bomb drops, day turns into night, people turn into ghosts. It is simple and elegant, a plea from the darkness to abolish nuclear weapons. This is what the Hibakusha, the survivors of the atomic nightmare of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, have been demanding since 1945. Their pleas have been heard around the world, but not in the capitals that have developed these hideous weapons. 9 of the 193 member states of the United Nations possess nuclear weapons. One of them, the United States of America, has more than half of all the 13,410 warheads. Four countries, namely the United States, Russia, Britain and France have at least 1,800 warheads on high alert, which means that they can be fired at very short notice. To compare the warheads currently deployed with the atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima is enough to make the heart stop. The yield from the little boy used on Hiroshima has been estimated at 15 kilotons, whereas the yield from one W-88 warhead that is deployed on a Trident II submarine is estimated at 475 kilotons. It is not just the number of nuclear weapons that are available. The current nuclear weapons, many of them deployed on submarines and ships, are far more lethal. None of the nine nuclear weapon states have joined the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. They boycotted the negotiations and the vote in the United Nations General Assembly. In October of 2020, the United States government circulated a letter asking those governments that signed the treaty to withdraw from it. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in 2017, Nikki Haley, claimed that the Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons threatened the security of the United States. She condescended to the 122 governments that joined the Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, saying, "Do they really understand the threats that we have?" As Prabir Purukayasva, an engineer and a science activist in the power, telecommunications and software sector, wrote in January of 2020, over the course of the past few years, the U.S. administration has undermined the three core treaties for disarmament: the Anti-Ballistic Missile, or ABM, Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, Treaty, and the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, which has now metamorphosed into the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START. Appetite for serious nuclear disarmament has simply not been evident. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, in the United States estimates that the government will spend $1.2 trillion between 2017 and 2046 to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The other eight nuclear weapon states will follow suit, but far behind, since in these matters the United States drives this terrifying agenda. While 122 countries voted to ban nuclear weapons, the United States pursued a project to threaten China with nuclear attack. In August of 2019, the U.S. withdrew from the INF Treaty, tested two intermediate-range missiles, and then posted an order for a variety of cruise and ballistic missiles. When the U.S. government sought bases for these missiles around China, its Asian allies balked. They do not want to inflame the already tense situation between Washington and Beijing. Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in 2020 that the Department of Defense has ramped up its efforts against China. These threats grew more and more explicit later that year. President Joe Biden's new Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said Donald Trump's administration was right to be tough on China. The presence of these missiles on U.S. naval vessels and the development of hypersonic cruise missiles, as well as open threats against China, simply make it impossible for Beijing to dismantle its nuclear arsenal. To do so would be tantamount to surrender before a U.S. attack. Meanwhile, China's government has said that it welcomes the establishment of nuclear-free zones, including the Southeast Asian Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone Treaty. At a press briefing in July of 2020, Fu Kong, Director General of China's Department of Arms Control and Disarmament in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said his country would be willing to enter disarmament negotiations if the U.S. arsenal at 5,800 nuclear missiles dropped down to the Chinese level of about 300 nuclear missiles. Fu Kong said the U.S. knows full well the huge gap between the Chinese and American nuclear arsenals, both in terms of quantity and sophistication, adding, "For the U.S., hyping up the China factor is nothing but a ploy to divert world attention and to create a pretext under which they could walk away from the new START treaty, as they have done on so many other arms control treaties." Fu Kong noted, "The real purpose is to get rid of all possible restrictions and have a free hand in seeking overwhelming military superiority over any adversary, real or imagined. Public opinion, even in many NATO countries, favors a total ban on nuclear weapons." After the Treaty for Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons went into force on 22nd of January this year, Beatrice Feen of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons addressed nuclear weapon states. She said, "Your weapons are now banned, permanently. You are on the wrong side of international law, the wrong side of history, and the wrong side of humanity." In 2017, The international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons won the Nobel Peace Prize. Nuclear disarmament has a long history. In 1961, the US and the former Soviet Union signed the McCloy-Zorin Accords, or the Agreed Principles for General and Complete Disarmament, which called for general and complete disarmament, but also that war should no longer be an instrument for settling international problems. Gone is that spirit, but it needs to be revived.
Food for thought.
Salam. Let us contemplate upon the words of Imam Ali, peace upon him, regarding his blissful marital life with Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. By Allah, I never angered Fatima or forced her to do something she did not like, up to the day she passed away. Nor did she ever anger or disobey me. In fact, when I looked at her, depression and sadness would vanish from my heart.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای قوم که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shoma dar in qarn mo'jiza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World and Is Still Changing It. Once again, we are going to be speaking about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, this great and holy personality who has certainly changed the world forever. And I'm going to, as usual, have a in-depth discussion about this great man's life with Dr. Hassani, who is once again has joined us on this program to discuss this very, very important personality, and I thank him for that. And Dr. Hassani, salam, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum.
Dr. Hassani, we finished off on the point about Ahlul Bayt. I think we were discussing the significance of the belief in this particular hadith that we were talking about in terms of the legacy of the Holy Prophet. And of course, Imam Khomeini, we mentioned before, comes from the holy family of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and he re-emphasized that very important hadith for the whole Muslim world, that there are two very, very valuable things that we should focus on, and that is the Holy Quran and the Holy Family of the Prophet, and that these two things should be given the importance and priority that they deserve. But to begin with, you know, we have to look at this great personality from the point of view that how does one actually study a great personality like Imam Khomeini? What's the kind of approach that's required in terms of trying to get to grips with such a complicated personality as Imam Khomeini? Because there are many, many dimensions to this holy soul that we have been discussing over the last 10 programs. Because it's not only a kind of one-dimensional personality. This is a multi-dimensional personality. And it's very difficult for, I think, many, many people. I mean, there's a book that has been published on Imam Khomeini, which is a compilation of what people have thought as in terms of expertise in politics, in economics, in religion, whatever it happens to be, in a book called Asr Imam Khomeini, The Era of Imam Khomeini. But to be honest, even going through that book, even when I was looking through that and, you know, translating it from Persian, you know, you find that, you know, simply seem to see one side or one aspect of this multidimensional being, and yet they don't quite fully grasp what he's done. So, Dr. Hassani, tell us, you know, because you're a researcher and an academic in the Holy Seminaries of Qom, as well as for the academia in Tehran, tell us, well, how does one actually approach this personality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
This is a very delicate subject.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to give you
sure.
the most simple example in order how to approach to study such a person like Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. And by the way, we are going to try. You know, there is no claim on our side.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, really, yeah, of course. I mean, trying is the word.
In order to understand somebody, you have to know the background of his life.
Sure.
I give it to you simple. The way that you should study somebody's life, you can look at what kind of claim he has, or she, for that matter.
Right.
What the claim might be, this is the beginning of to enter the gate of studying. You know, in English, the word search and research.
Yeah.
Search is more simpler than research, of course.
Of course it is.
When you lose something, you know, let's suppose you lose your car key.
Right.
And if you ask your wife, where is that?
Yeah. The national, and she always tells you it's
exactly.
in your pocket.
But to get serious, if it's not in your pocket and you misplace it,
sure.
the natural thing to say is, why don't you look for it?
Yeah.
Why don't you search for it?
Search for it.
But you don't use the word research.
No, you don't.
If you search for it once, if you look for it once, and you still cannot find it, they might say to you, why don't you re-look somewhere else? In order to understand so many different things, different phenomena, if you look at the word itself, it helps you to begin with. Let me give you an example. What Imam Khomeini claimed in his holy life, that 80 some years of his age within us, that was a big claim. I can tell you right away, he had the same claim that Prophet did.
And that, what claim was that?
The claim is that everybody should live according to the rules and laws of the Creator to be a good person.
Right.
for example, in order to study the life, the holy life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny.
Sure.
In order to understand Islam, you have to study his life. In order to understand what kind of background he's coming from, what kind of claim, and that was a big claim, by
yes.
the way.
Yeah.
He was Rahmatan Lil Alameen. He
That's
was
right, the mercy
for
to
the
mankind.
Entire mankind.
For the whole of mankind, yes.
Not
yes.
just the mankind of his own time,
sure.
but for the rest of creation.
Yes.
For
and of course the Holy Prophet had to also validate his prophethood
exactly.
as well, because there were many other monotheistic followers, or Hanifs even, mm-hmm. who followed Prophet Abraham, who followed Prophet Moses, for example, or Christianity as Prophet Jesus.
Which is a chain order.
Yeah, chain order.
Of
but
the
they,
same message.
But they said, they, as far as they were concerned, they turned around and they said to the Holy Prophet, that look, we've been given the last revelation. We have the last claim on this matter. Where do you come into all this?
Mm-hmm. So, in order to study Islam and the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him,
sure.
the first thing comes to your mind, the location, the geography
right.
that he lived in.
Right.
Of course, it was Arabian Peninsula.
Uh-huh.
But in order to look at the bigger picture, you have to study the entire globe at that time.
Yes.
This is something, you know, often we forget or we take for granted.
Yes.
We say it's enough to learn about the... It wasn't a new religion. It was the continuation of all the religion that Prophet Abraham was talking about, Prophet Noah, and so on and so
sure,
forth.
Because
it was the completion of the whole program. So one thing comes to mind, you know, during the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the ignorance of the people at the time. For example, they killed their own daughters by their own hand.
Yes.
For whatever the reason. We're not going to get into that.
No.
But my question to you is this,
sure.
Brother Ejaz.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about what people did in China back then?
Yes, I have.
But you have to put everything
because
in perspective.
Because you're right. No, what I'm
you talk
saying
about
is
civilization, you talk about the culture.
Exactly,
here.
Because you know what you're saying is, and it's beautifully put, and that's absolutely right, that you know when you think of 7th century, you have to think exactly what the world was like in the 7th century.
Exactly. You have to study Romans Persian, they called them.
Yeah. I mean, in the 7th century, Rome itself as a republic had stood for almost 1,000 years and, you know, had conquered most of the known world at that time.
That is true.
And the thing is that, as you say, we are putting everything in a context. So what you're saying is the beginning of your search is really
By definition. Research is not something just, you know, you do it on surface.
Exactly.
You have to go into a deeper...
And more broader understanding of exactly what's happening.
All different phenomena that you can find.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So... Indian, for example, Chinese back
exactly.
then,
yeah.
Persians, Romans, how about Egyptians?
Yes. One of the oldest standing civilizations in the region.
See, you have to think about the whole thing, the
sure.
whole picture.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with the life of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yes, yes, quite.
You have to study not just what was going on inside Iran back then, okay? Domestically, you have to know what kind of mentality people had back then.
Sure.
What kind of... economical situation they were in.
In other words, in terms of understanding how outstanding and how awesome Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was in terms of what he, as you say, what he claimed, but we have to see it in the light of the fact that he's in the face of a very dominant, powerful culture at that
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
For which they
Iran,
had no answer.
The position of Iran domestically...
Yeah.
In the regional, in what they call the Middle East,
sure.
and the role of foreigners.
Yes.
American government.
Both in the country and outside the country.
Both in the country and outside.
Yeah.
All these different phenomena, different realities on the ground, it affects your research.
Of course it does.
And it draws the conclusion differently.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
What kind of economical situation was established in Iran? Before revolution, and you have to get, don't get me wrong, you have to go way back, at least for 20 years before revolution.
Yes.
What kind of mentality, Imam, what kind of background Imam Khomeini was coming from?
Yes.
This is very important in doing research.
Yeah.
And you always have to go back again and do the check and balance.
Exactly.
And check it with the references.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, like as you point out, I mean, there's many references involved here because Imam Khomeini is coming on the back, not only on the back, but also was leading in many ways this very revolutionary change in Iran because, you know, the fact that, you know, he had a referendum right at the beginning, which was outstanding. I mean, nobody expected that a guy who would come out of Hawza, who would come out of the seminaries, would preach a referendum to validate a republic, an Islamic republic.
You have to be as big as the universe itself in order to tackle this kind of problem.
Exactly.
This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Because we believe, you know. Mm. By the way, Imam Khomeini lived according to his belief.
Yeah, sorry, but on the background that you had dictatorship in the form of monarchy, where the vote was not heard of, and when the CIA got whiff of the fact that Mossadegh, the prime minister in 1951,
you know,
was going down this road.
It's easy to say that the system was monarchy.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But for them, they acted like a pharaoh. They were so big.
Yeah.
I mean, they would call themselves all this king of kings.
Kings,
yes. They called themselves the shadow of God.
Yes, there was also that claim as well.
That made the story different.
Yes.
I mean, for us, after revolution, we're talking about, Brother Ejaz, this is years after revolution, the Islamic revolution we're talking. It's so easy to talk.
Yeah.
But in order to put yourself in that situation, it's very difficult and it takes time. And it takes a struggle in order to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, our claim is this, that Islam is a perfect one, perfect program for humanity, the entire globe.
Sure.
So this is a big claim.
Yeah.
And Imam Khomeini in claiming and believing in this is no exception.
No.
But the thing is that as a great leader, everything he claimed, he had to have a backup.
Yeah.
A social understanding to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay? After all, Islam is a collective, comprehensive, general, it's a broad religion.
Yeah.
Which claims that it can take good care of every human
need.
Affairs and needs.
And needs, yes.
And it will. Yeah. You have to prove it that.
Where?
Because we have to come up with a social and economical and political system.
Yeah.
And you know, nowadays...
Well, I mean, to be fair...
You can see the result of it.
To be fair, as you say, that, you know, when you put this into a context, and that's very important in terms of research, and that is what you're saying, that the approach has to be comprehensive. Because if you... It's like, you know, like we're doing modeling, for example. I mean, I come from an engineering background, and of course, if your model lacks...
Which makes a good example.
Yeah. If your model lacks certain assumptions which don't really fill the parameters of the exact thing that you're trying to analyze, well, the result is going to be pretty
skewed.
And
you always have, in order to write a good building, you always have to use the plumb line.
Exactly, exactly. But what I'm saying here is that we want to put all the ingredients into our research approach so that we get the right kind of... we take the right kind of, what do you call, the result that we really need in terms of understanding the entire approach that this great personality did. Because as you say, the claim is very great. But to be fair, in the context of history, even though, you know, that's very controversial, and many of us who have studied Muslim history in the past come away with a very negative impression of the overall picture of what the Muslim world was like for many, many centuries. But we can't ignore the fact that Islam, even in whatever shape or form it was for many centuries, dominated the entire globe for almost 1,000 years, for which Europe had no answer. Even though the Muslim world was broken up into 3 or 4 empires. There was the Empire of Spain, of Andalusia. There was the Empire of the Mughal India. There was the Empire of the Safavids in Iran. There was the Empire of the Ottomans. So, I mean, although they come in successive chronological order, I mean, we're not saying they're all happening at the same time, but whatever periods of history in which there were fundamental changes, But even though at the end of the day, Europe, whatever modern Europe is now, it couldn't have happened unless Islam was there. So although we are saying it's a big claim for many, many needs, but it's because there has been a vacuum since the time that these empires collapsed, and then Muslims started to fall backwards economically, politically, because Europe started to take over and started to dominate this the rest of history until the present day. But in that light, Imam Khomeini is still coming from a context in which Islam still left a very great legacy for the rest of the world to follow.
Big claim deserves big struggle.
Sure.
Okay, the moment you're not claiming anything, so it's so easy for you to deal with whatever. Nobody's going to ask you. Nobody's going to question you. Nobody's going to challenge you.
Yeah.
But the moment you claim something,
yeah,
you have to
validate it.
You have to validate it. You have to come out of it clean.
Sure.
Okay, in order to finish that introduction that I gave
for
those that please they do. Have some problems, you know, we talk about ideology here. Okay?
Mm.
Those people, and they're coming from different school of thought, whatever, for what different reason. We're not getting into that. Mm. It's not going to help us much.
Mm.
But to those that who claim they always that coming Islam, returning Islam inside the country, the Persia, it's very easy for them to say they call it Arab invasion, which wasn't the case.
No,
you
it
talk
wasn't.
About if you talk about material, how come a great empire like Persian, like old Persian empire, could collapse in a short period of time, and they claim that Arab soldiers, you know, they came to Iran with sword. So Iranian army back then, they didn't have sword to defend their own country.
Let's put it in some historical context. Here we are talking about...
Because when you do research, you have to do a lot of
we
studies.
We are talking about the time...
You have to do a lot of comparison.
Exactly.
You have to do a lot of different things.
Well, there's a lot of PhDs that have been written on the thesis that have been done on this research. But we're talking about...
I hope those PhDs doesn't mean please hold a debate.
No.
So they should be able, in order to back whatever they say with facts.
But the thing is, whatever they've come up with, and this has stunned them, in all honesty, when they have come up with these, and I've seen some of these theses, where they have been absolutely stunned by the extraordinary speed with which the Muslim empire started to expand. Because we're talking about, as you quite rightly say, a Persian empire that stood for about...
What happened? This is a simple question.
Yeah, 3,500 years... Right? Taking it to its origin, but it only collapses within the 10-year period of the second caliph, if I can put it that way, within a matter of a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary. How does that happen?
One should ask himself why.
Why? Exactly.
We don't have to give answers to any questions.
No.
I mean, the approach for some people should be differently.
Yeah.
I mean, for as long as you want to stay student, you're not going to grow.
Yeah.
All these different lectures, speeches you go to, all different books you read, which is fine. You're supposed to do that.
Sure.
But for a second, come out of yourself. This is my claim.
Yeah.
This is my way of approaching things.
Sure.
You have to pause for a second and say, look, I am somebody in this creation too.
Sure.
I can be as big as whoever.
Mm.
I can achieve as much as
whoever
somebody else
sure
did. Okay?
Sure.
There is an Imam Khomeini inside every single of us, because we're going to talk about that claim. That claim is of a genuine one.
Mm.
When you talk about justice, you're not talking about something in vacuum.
No.
You talk about reality on the ground. You
sure.
know, back during Shah's regime,
sure,
we lived it.
Mm.
I felt it. I saw the unjust, okay? With different talent, good talent, you know, bunch of elite people, if they were not attached to the system, to the monarch system, if, for example, they disputed, they challenged the system of king, which was very difficult,
sure,
they could face torture, they could face imprisonment, they could face to be sent into exile, just like they sent Imam Khomeini to exile.
Sure, sure.
Okay, what did he do? What did he say for the regime, you know, to actually, if you want to describe it, the way that they took Imam from his his house in Qom, it was some kind of kidnapping.
Sure.
How come a civilization, somebody who claimed that he can take care of people...
Well, Dr. Husni, I wanted to say here that you're drawing a very, very interesting parallel here, because you already... You're drawing a line here where you're saying that it's that interesting...
And my mission here is to raise questions. So many different of them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, if you let me finish my point,
please.
That is that there's two interesting parallels you're drawing here. You're drawing about how Iran or the Persian Empire, in the context of the 7th, 8th century, how it quickly was absorbed by Islam, which was a miracle in itself. And that's something that, as you quite rightly say, is something that, you know, PhDs have been written on. But we are drawing also the fact that the Pahlavi regime in Iran was established for, you know, in a coup d'etat in 1941, the Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that we knew, the one that was...
The role of British behind it.
Yeah, the British and the Americans in the coup.
U.S. administration, yes.
50 years it was established by the great superpowers, the principal superpower being the Americans.
And 50 years is a long way.
A long way where
to
Iran...
rule people's heart.
Exactly. And in Iran... it was established as the policeman of the Gulf.
The gendarme of the region.
With a very, very powerful army, one of the strongest in the region. Even Israel was no match for whatever the Shah was getting at the time. And how did that quickly dissolve the way it did by this great personality? I mean, it draws two very interesting parallels about Iran's history in the face of Islam.
Good question again. If you go look at the history, what kind of situation people were in. My answer to you is very simple. It all boils down to one thing. And
yes.
The word is dignity.
Ah.
We're talking about reference here. لَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. Quran is talking to us. Anytime you want to study somebody, look or study the ideology behind that
person.
Mentality behind that person.
Person, yes.
You cannot study Imam Khomeini without knowing Quran.
Would I be wrong in saying, Dr. Husni, dignity and faith?
Dignity and faith, they're going together. Okay?
Right.
But dignity is something that if somebody claims, you know, on the surface that, oh, I don't believe in, even if I don't believe in God, but I'm not a beast, I'm not animal, I'm human for God's sake. Then he says, for God's sake. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Unintentionally
uses
the word.
Word.
Okay?
Because God gave
because
the dignity,
God gave him
the honor and dignity
God,
to man.
God gave it to him.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Dignity is not something...
And it's being trampled on by dictatorship.
Exactly. And this is what you see. If you ask me what happened to Egyptian people, why they came to the Tahrir Square to regain their dignity. The dignity that it was kidnapped, it was hijacked.
Hijacked.
It was robbed, I
robbed,
should say.
Robbed, yes.
This is
robbed,
a better
I
word.
Think, is a better word, yeah.
If you feel that you are abused, okay,
yeah.
If you all feel that you are attacked with every single cell in your entire body, by the way, if you have to talk about this in a deeper and different layer, you have to talk about the definition of human.
Yes.
According to what Islam
says. Yes, that's right, because
okay.
that's the ideology we're coming from.
Because remember, one of the, we're talking about human problems in general in the last program. And one thing I mentioned that we are trapped into these five
senses. That's right.
But there is something beyond that. Okay.
And this is what this expertise also witnessed to the fact that, you know, beyond whatever intelligence or whatever things were there in place in order to, because let's be honest here. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was never, ever envisaged by the Americans or the Soviet Union for that matter, that such a person would ever come to power in Iran. They were expecting the Shah to be there forevermore. Amen. So, that, as you quite rightly say, according to that, those materialistic senses and sights, the intelligence went badly wrong.
Brother, when one way of studying one society is to get back to their song.
Get back to the hymn sheet.
Exactly. In West,
and start singing from